because we got the alternative energy. Right. Nuclear free autonomy.
And welcome to the Radioactive Show, produced at the studios of 3CR Melbourne and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
The militarized conceptions of security, where violence equals strength and might equals right, is very patriarchal. And nuclear weapons in this context are tools to hold and exercise power through threats and through violence as well. I mean, they are the sort of pinnacle of violent potential that a state has.
I'm Michaela, and today we mark the 16 days of activism on gender-based violence by hearing from Ray Atchison, an organizer, activist, writer, and director of Reaching Critical Will, the disarmament program of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the world's oldest feminist peace organization. In a patriarchal society, masculinity is equated with the willingness to use force and violence. And there's no greater symbol of this in our times than nuclear weapons, the most extreme tool to inflict violence, and a violence where the destruction is intergenerational, passed on through genetic damage within the body, and nuclear waste that will continue to harm life for hundreds of thousands of years. And nuclear weapons also have racialized and gendered impacts, disproportionately impacting women and Indigenous peoples, whose lands are stolen for uranium extraction and treated as sacrifice zones for testing of nuclear weapons and dumping of nuclear waste. The entire nuclear industry is built on a colonial possession that uses violence to extract sacred materials from the earth without consent. Ray writes in a 2023 briefing paper, "Nuclear weapons are gendered. They have gendered impacts. Their existence is predicated on and perpetuated in part due to gendered norms about power, violence, and security. And their abolition is challenged by the lack of gender and other forms of diversity in discussions and negotiations related to nuclear policy." It was revealed in Senate estimates on Wednesday, 3rd of December, that the Australian government would permit visits by US Virginia-class submarines that may carry nuclear weapons in the future. Senior defence officials acknowledge that there is no impediment under Australian policy or treaty obligations to the visit of dual-capable platforms, an aircraft, submarine, or missile designed to carry either conventional weapons or nuclear weapons, and reiterated that Australia would continue to respect the US policy of neither confirming nor denying the presence of nuclear weapons. Experts, including CNA analyst Decca Eveleth, have confirmed these weapons can be deployed on Virginia-class submarines, the same submarines Australia is preparing to host at HMAS Stirling as early as 2027. Jem Rommel, director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons Australia, said, "The Foreign Minister's assurances that nuclear weapons won't be rotating through Australia is now dead in the water. It's taken just 2 years for expectations of an AUKUS partner to shift. So what will come next? If AUKUS is not about nuclear weapons, then Australia's numerous assurances must be backed up with legal commitments. The best way to draw the line on nuclear weapons is to sign and ratify the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons." And so we can see it is more important than ever to push for Australia to sign on the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that entered into force in January 2021 and made nuclear weapons illegal under international law. Between 2008 to 2024, Ray Atchison served on the steering group of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for its work to initiate and organize for the ban. Ray wrote about this work in their book Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, and today we bring you excerpts from a book launch event hosted on the 5th of May 2021 by the Elliott School of International Affairs.
Patriarchy is so bound up with militarism and racism and capitalism. They're all connected systems of power and oppression that order our world. And feminist perspectives on power and violence I've found to be extremely useful for understanding this world. When you're sitting in the UN trying to figure out what's going on between states, it's extremely relevant and useful to help unpack a lot of the dynamics that you're seeing and to really understand the core issues behind the way our global system has ordered itself. And that's also why I wrote this book. I wanted to provide a feminist history of the negotiations of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and the whole process that led up to the negotiations. And I wanted to also offer not just a feminist history, but also a perspective from a firsthand activist and organizer who was involved in this work from the very beginning.
I wondered if you could discuss a little bit more about the importance of adopting the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons in July of 2017 and the impact that it's had on the international community and nuclear strategy around the globe.
Absolutely, yes. So one of the main impacts that it's had on the world already, certainly within the UN itself, but more broadly than that, is a challenge to the nuclear orthodoxy, to the theory of deterrence, the idea that might equals right, and the idea that not everyone is equal before the law, the sort of, you know, the hierarchy of power that's constituted in global nuclear governance regimes like the Non-Proliferation Treaty, for example. It also provides a challenge to the idea that only certain militarily active states or nuclear armed states can have a say about nuclear weapons. It was a way in which to elevate the voice of governments as well as activists in countries that don't possess nuclear weapons and that have actively renounced nuclear weapons and have policies against deterrence and that speak out against these systems and frameworks of power and violence in the world. It's the first categorical prohibition of nuclear weapons, which means that these weapons are now on the same footing as other weapons of mass destruction, like chemical and biological weapons, and other indiscriminate weapons like landmines and cluster bombs. So it's the first time that nuclear weapons have been brought into that order of the law. Before, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, there is a article in that treaty that obligates all of the nuclear armed states to eliminate their nuclear arsenals, to negotiate in good faith nuclear disarmament, which means achieving the elimination, but they haven't complied with that aspect of the treaty. And so while the Non-Proliferation Treaty has largely been successful in terms of restricting the spread of nuclear weapons, it hasn't had that same effect in relation to disarmament. And so one of the tools that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons brings to the table is that it does provide this categorical and definitive prohibition of all nuclear weapon-related activities. It's also the first feminist law on nuclear weapons that we've ever had. I describe it as being feminist both in process and in product. So in terms of process, it is a treaty that was negotiated in the UN General Assembly, which is the most democratic forum we have in the UN system, where every state, regardless of size, has an equal vote, and where voting is allowed in several other UN. This rules in those bodies where everyone has to be in complete agreement in order to move forward, which obviously privileges those who don't want to give up their weapons or who don't want to make progress on a certain issue. And so the General Assembly offered a space where we could avoid those strangleholds on the process of nuclear disarmament. And it also was a process that was deliberately framed in a way to bring in and be inclusive of and amplify the perspectives of countries that have been affected by nuclear weapon testing, countries that have not necessarily been large voices within the nuclear disarmament discourse internationally, but have a lot to say on the issue because of where they are historically in relation to colonialism or other oppressions from militarism. There was an effort by many of the champions of the treaty process to ensure that, for example, young women diplomats from countries of the Global South could attend the meetings in Geneva and New York. So there was a sponsorship program to ensure that that inclusivity and diversity wasn't just rhetoric, that it actually occurred. And then in terms of product, it's the first treaty that recognizes the gendered impacts of nuclear weapons, which we'll talk about a little bit later. It also recognizes the disproportionate impacts of nuclear weapon activities on indigenous communities. It recognizes the suffering of the Hibakusha, the survivors of the nuclear bombings. And it also provides for environmental remediation, victim assistance. So it has these positive obligations for states parties to the treaty in relation to nuclear weapon activities. And it encourages all governments to ensure gender diversity in terms of participation in future meetings and in nuclear disarmament in general. So it's also been impactful in that way. It's revitalized the humanitarian environmental discourse on nuclear weapons. These were, of course, major topics in the 1960s and the 1980s. That was the dominant discourse around nuclear weapons, but it slipped away with the end of the Cold War. And so bringing that back to the fore, educating a new generation of activists around the world, as well as government officials and diplomats and others working on this issue, updating the studies to account for what we now know about climate change and other factors that would interplay with nuclear weapons, all of that has been very important and impactful as well. The whole process centered the lived experience of survivors from the nuclear weapon complex and invited survivors into the negotiating space. And all of this is important, not just in relation to nuclear abolition, but it's also important for other pursuits of social justice and abolition of other structures and systems of violence, and for how we conduct international relations. It offers a glimpse of what's possible when people like diplomats, organizers, activists come together to build a critical mass for change.
You have written in the introduction to Beyond Arms Control and elsewhere, the nuclear armed states offer rhetoric about their commitment to nuclear disarmament as a future goal while working to maintain an unequal order of nuclear haves and have-nots through the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is true even after the end of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. How do gendered power dynamics and feminist theory explain the current global order in relation to nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament?
I think I'll focus on that part about how the gendered power dynamics and feminist theory really explain this system, because I think that it's essential, and as we talked about in the beginning, so I'm happy to dig into this a little bit more. Analysis about security and dominance and control, understanding these through a feminist analysis of patriarchy and power, I think is really essential. The militarized conceptions of security, where violence equals strength and might equals right, is very patriarchal, and nuclear weapons in this context are tools to hold and exercise power through threats and through violence as well. I mean, they are the sort of pinnacle of violent potential that a state has. All of the theories around nuclear weapons, the manufactured myths, if you will, the sort of the concepts of nuclear deterrence or geostrategic stability, we need more weapons, you know, the sort of arms racing mentality of mutually assured destruction, all of the ideas and concepts and theories that got us to 80,000 nuclear weapons at the height of the Cold War. This is all part of a patriarchal system of this violence and power. And the way that these sort of theories really render invisible the actual violence and sort of the weapon in the weapon. And Carol Cohen writes really well about this. You mentioned her earlier. I'd recommend her work to everybody, from the 80s in particular, around looking at how the techno-strategic discourse is really meant to abstract and use euphemisms that dilute the actual inherent violence within nuclear weapons, and treating them as these magical tools that will somehow preserve peace and security in the world, despite the fact that they can annihilate all of us. Also, the ways that patriarchal techniques are used to quell debate. So me saying these things is not allowed. Things like gaslighting and victim blaming is utilized frequently. In the United Nations, we hear it all the time. We hear it from academics, of course, too. Who is considered credible? What are the things you are allowed to say that will get you taken seriously and not just sort of stared at blankly or laughed out of the room? We are, as activists, but also we've seen time and again through the negotiation of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the diplomats involved in that process also were told that by focusing on the humanitarian impacts of nuclear weapons, by pursuing the prohibition of these weapons, that we were being emotional, that we were being irrational, that we were naive. Some of these governments were told that they didn't have any real security interests and they couldn't possibly understand the security needs of the so-called big powers. So all of this is part and parcel of patriarchal techniques to ridicule, undermine, challenge the credibility of the speaker that many of us working across any field will recognize very well. And all of this sets the stage for a minority, to claim the right and responsibility, if you will, of nuclear possession. And everyone else has to just let them deal with the situation. And they tell us that they cannot possibly disarm because of the, quote, international security environment. But of course, this is an environment that's been created mostly by these states in contest with each other, created through the history of colonialism, through neoliberal imperialism, through wars and occupations abroad, through nuclear contestation with each other. And so it's just massive feat of gaslighting there to attribute responsibility for the challenges we face on other people and then be told that they have to maintain the right to essentially execute all of us in a moment in order to maintain the stability of the situation they've created. So all of that doesn't make sense if you don't have a feminist analysis, in my opinion. If you don't have a post-structural analysis, an anti-imperialist analysis that you can bring to this work, because otherwise it's much harder to come from the position of inside this system of global power to critique it if you don't have these tools and understandings and can see how this whole construction has been fabricated in order to suit the interests of the few.
You're tuned to The Radioactive Show, produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio on unceded Kulin land and broadcast across the continent thanks to the Community Radio Network. We're hearing Ray Atchison speaking at a launch event for their book, Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, that shares an activist feminist perspective on the work of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons to build for the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. In ICAN's media release, Government Backflips on Nuclear-Capable Submarines Under AUKUS, Jem Rommel, director of ICAN Australia, states, "Australia is a strong proponent of the 1970 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, an essential multilateral agreement, but one that is no longer fit for purpose. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons extends the work of the NPT to meet the challenges posed by today's nuclear risks, and in finally comprehensively outlawing these weapons of mass destruction. Both of our AUKUS partners are heavily armed with nuclear weapons. As a nation opposed to nuclear weapons, signing the TPNW puts essential protections and future-proofing in place for our country and our region." Let's return to hear some more from Ray Atchison.
I'd like to ask you a question. It kind of ties together the last few comments you've been making. You talk about gendered power structures and the importance of using survivors really as the drivers of this process. And I'd like to hear you speak about how nuclear weapons disproportionately affect women, specifically Indigenous women, and why it is essential to include more women in the conversation surrounding disarmament and nuclear policy. Furthermore, how can the U.S. rectify injustices caused by its legacy of nuclear weapons production, testing, and waste storage?
It's a multi-part answer, I guess, to this. The first thing is around the physical impacts and their disproportionate effects on women. So ionizing radiation affects women's and girls' bodies differently due to tissue absorption and reproductive systems. And this has been seen in studies in the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, of course, but also Chernobyl and Fukushima. In addition here, there are certain social practices that can lead to disproportionate gendered impacts. So for example, a few years ago, a UN Special Rapporteur on Toxic Waste did a study in the Marshall Islands on US nuclear testing there and found that men and women were differentially impacted by the tests because of different social practices. So for example, women and men traditionally ate different parts of a fish at mealtime, and the parts that the women ate had more radiation contained within those elements of the fish. So there's all kinds of these things that don't necessarily enter into people's minds when we think about the grave disproportionate impacts of nuclear weapons, but there are ways that they can have differences. But I always get, this is important, but it's also, I get a little wary of it just because it's quite binary. And we're talking about men and women. And so of course I don't accept a binary. And I also want to stress that while these findings are important for understanding radiation and impacts of nuclear weapons, it's also important to take an intersectional look. And so I was really pleased that you asked about Indigenous women in particular, because this is an example of intersectional analysis. So most nuclear weapon activities have taken place on Indigenous lands and waters, whether that's been uranium mining or weapons production to nuclear testing through to radioactive waste storage. So in the U.S., a lot of this has taken place on Navajo Nation or Western Shoshone lands around the country and other nations around the country. Also, like I said, the British in Australia on Indigenous territory, the French in Algeria, Russia and Kazakhstan, France and the Pacific. So we can see the ways in which there's a lot of radioactive racism, as we call it, or radioactive colonialism or imperialism are terms that we use in this work to really describe how nuclear weapon activities have been implicated across the world in a very specific pattern. And so it's important from this perspective to not just talk about harms to women as a monolithic group or to assume that, you know, there's one experience of women around the world with nuclear weapons or that or anything else, but to make sure that we're including women and others from affected communities with lived experiences whose lives have been impacted by not just the physical implications of nuclear weapons, but also the economic resources that have spent on nuclear weapons and other aspects of the complex. And so it's important to enhance gender, racial, and class diversity within the discussions that we're having on nuclear weapons. And I should say here, of course, that diversity and inclusion can't just be then about incorporating women into, or others, into the structures of violence, into the systems that perpetuate the same myths, into these credible, this language of credibility that I talked about earlier. But in order to challenge and dismantle and create new mechanisms or new discourses and new ways of operating. So it's not just about adding people with certain identities into existing institutions and processes, but actively working to create space for different ideas and perspectives and experiences to actually change those institutions and the processes that we engage in. So the TPNW, I think, really started this work in many ways on nuclear weapons, but we have a lot more to do.
How can the UN Security Council resolutions on women, peace, and security support and be better implemented to support the movement towards complete disarmament, towards a completely anti-nuclear world?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and very, very important. I think it really builds off of what I was saying about it can't just be about including women or others in structures of violence and militarism that we have now. But unfortunately, a lot of the way that the Women, Peace and Security resolutions have been implemented has gone in that direction in terms of adding women to the military or to national security structures, and really focusing on that as the best way to implement WPS. So, you know, national action plans become these accounting projects where you're looking at, oh, how many women did we add to the military this year? What's our percentage? And that kind of thing. Whereas really what the originators of the Women, Peace and Security agenda really wanted was to be about conflict prevention, right? It wasn't about protecting women in conflict. That's what it came to be. But the women who really dreamed up the resolution and tried to do the advocacy originally for it, it was about preventing conflict and preventing harm, rather than protecting women from harm in conflict. So I think that we need to be listening to feminists and anti-militarists and anti-nuclear organizers and others that are invested in the prevention of harms in order to look at how we're implementing these resolutions and where we can go from here. So focusing on preventing armed conflict is important. This is going to mean looking at the international arms trade, stopping arms transfers that are fueling conflict and causing gender-based violence or other human rights and IHL violations. Reducing military budgets is a big one, and diverting that money towards investments in care and equality, like jobs, housing, education, food security, climate and environmental protection, all of that good stuff. And in the same bucket, I suppose, as reducing military budgets, would be abolishing nuclear weapons and diverting that money, defunding and demilitarizing and demobilizing war and police, etc. I think also important for implementation efforts in this, in the Women, Peace and Security agenda, means including communities that are affected by conflict, particularly the most marginalized, which are often Black, Indigenous, other people of color, queer, disabled folks. So really having an actual intersectional lens and not just treating women as a monolithic group, like I was saying earlier, thinking through what people actually need to survive and thrive, and not just diversifying the war machine, so to speak. And so I think, you know, this was, again, I want to stress, the original vision for Women, Peace and Security. It was ending war, not equalizing women's participation in war. And it was preventing harm, not enabling women to perpetuate harm on an equal basis. And Cynthia Enloe has a great quote about this. Many of you are probably familiar with her feminist scholarship, but if you're not, I highly recommend her as well. And she says, you can militarize anything, even equality. And it's so true. And it's not just about women's participation too, right? We can see these diversity inclusion efforts in terms of the police or military contractors showing up to march and pride marches and stuff like that too. We can see it in all the different ways that there's an attempt by militarism, by power, to accommodate and incorporate everyone into its system as a way to prevent us from challenging it from the outside. So I think all of that is really important to keep in mind when we're talking about Women, Peace and Security and the UN.
We just heard Rae Acheson speaking at the launch event for the 2021 book, Banning the Bomb, Smashing the Patriarchy, that offers a look inside the anti-nuclear movement and its recent successful campaign to ban the nuclear bomb. You can find Rae's writing on their website, rayeacheson.com. rayacheson.com. Thanks to the Elliott School of International Affairs for the recordings, and we'll link to the full talk in our podcast notes. You can find all our podcasts at 3cr.org.au/radioactive. And to get involved with the campaign for the elimination of the nuclear weapons and to push Australia to sign the treaty, go to icanw.org.au. To support First Nations people working to protect people and planet from nuclear risks, go to the Australian Nuclear Free Alliance website, anfa.org.au. And Reaching Critical Will website is reachingcriticalwill.org. Thanks to the Nuclear Free Collective at Friends of the Earth Melbourne for their ongoing support for the program, and the Community Radio Network for getting the show out to radio stations across the continent every week. A huge shout out to all those mobilising against the military in Mullumbimba, Newcastle. Follow Demilitarise Newcastle and Disrupt Wars on social media for all the updates. Tune in again next week for more news and views on nuclear peace and energy issues.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.